Monday, May 17th, was the day of the state dinner for President Park of Korea and his wife. It was memorable mostly for the extraordinary sweetness of Mrs. Park and the tense late hours that Lyndon and his staff kept on the Dominican situation. Mrs. Smith had come down from New York to wrap up our various projects, Lucy's solarium and my sitting room and the West Hall, and more important, Lyndon's little office in the fish room, and an exploratory excursion into the cabinet room. But first order of the day was the reception on the South Grounds. In my best spring outfit, the yellow and white dress and jacket, I was in Lyndon's office at 11:30. I could understand why the general and the hands would get ulcers trying to make these affairs click on time. How could one ever get used to such pomp and display? The South Lawn was beautiful with spring. Mrs. Park's smile was radiant. First blast of the 21-gun salute almost made my heart jump out of my throat. As always, but I am getting a little used to them. One of the nicest things was to think how thrilling it was to the Philip Baldwins who were somewhere back in the crowd watching, and probably Suzanne Walker King, Joseph Davies' granddaughter, who had come with Barbara Howard to watch and go through the White House, would find it a thrill, too. In all these meetings, Lyndon always towers above the visiting chief of state or monarch, and I confess that pleases me. In their speeches, Lyndon renewed America's guarantees to stand by Korea so long as danger remains, spoke gratefully of the 2,000 or so South Koreans who were fighting with us in South Vietnam. President Park's achievements, it appears, are to have begun making a normal relationship with Japan and lending their aid to us in South Vietnam. After all, they have one of the biggest military establishments in Asia. On our way into the diplomatic room to shake hands with the officials, the way was lined with the beautiful young wives of our staff. A new frill added by Lloyd Hand. Lyndon escorted President Park, and I, Mrs. Park, in a glass-top limousine, and we paraded down the ceremonial street, Pennsylvania Avenue, flag-decked, and back to Blair House, and on the way talked about Mrs. Park's delightful gift of 25 magnolia trees to the Ellipse and to other parks in Washington. They're Korean magnolias. This is a gracious gesture on her part because of our beautification program. Her vivacity and enthusiasm, speaking any language, and her lack of English, though she has some, did not prevent her from making contact. How wise she was to wear the native dress. The paper described it as diaphanous lake blue. It was long, flowing, embroidered. Your eyes were drawn to it in any crowd. It was suited to the delicacy and grace of her person. We said goodbye on the steps of Blair House, and I breathed my silent gratitude to Robin Duke or Mrs. Kennedy, whoever was responsible for establishing that lovely, totally acceptable guest house to take the place of the Queen's room and the Lincoln bedroom right down the hall from me. Because back to the White House I went for more desk chores and decorating chores with Mrs. Smith. And then I got a call from Lyndon, a request to come swim with him. I've been trying to get him back in the pool, back into exercises, ever since last September. This was victory. When I arrived there, I found, however, he had Jack Valenti and Bill and Abe, and they were talking business while they swam. But just as well, we took Abe upstairs with us for lunch. He leaned over when Lyndon was on the phone and said to me, holding his thumb and finger close together, "We are this close to a settlement." He meant in the Dominican Republic. I do not know, try not to know, much that is going on. What I don't know, I can't talk about, unwittingly and in front of the wrong people. The names of Mr. G and Davidson, other names, go back and forwards. Sometimes I wonder if such people exist. John Secondary drove with me to the beauty parlor to talk about our ABC program, in which soon I must become immersed. The Peterherds were to be house guests. After much research and checking, relying very much on John Walker, with Clark Clifford speaking for the Historical Society, I've asked Peterherd to do the president's portrait. And then a very unpleasant incident came up in the afternoon. Poor dear Liz, harassed, angry, had to tell me about it. It appears that a letter that Mrs. Kennedy had written me in October of 60 asking me to come to a party to listen to the TV debates between the then candidate Kennedy and candidate, Nixon, had somehow left my files, my possession, and was going to be auctioned off by a New York firm of collectors. How did it get there? Who in my employ steals? The company would only say that it had come from someone who said I gave it to them as a campaign souvenir. Liz asked me, of course I never did. On the other hand, with dozens, hundreds of volunteer help, of moves from two houses, it is quite possible it might have been lost or stolen. At any rate, it was embarrassing and ugly and took up too many minutes of our time, even hours. Somehow, I think Liz felt worse about it than I did. I wore my lovely new dress at the dinner, white with little flowers all over the sleeves, the inevitable connection with the beautification program. The Humphreys, the Rusks, Ambassador and Mrs. Brown joined us in the yellow room. Lyndon hurried, flying hundreds of miles southward, rushed into his dinner clothes, but was nevertheless downstairs on the north portico in time to greet the President and Mrs. Park. And then we spent a very pleasant half hour pointing out the monuments, exchanging the gifts, a major one from them. It was a magnificent tenfold screen, hand-painted with Korean landscape scenes, very muted, soft, and the one I always get the most kick out of pointing out to the visiting chief is a picture of their country taken from our satellite high up in the air. How delightful that our ambassador to Korea, his wife, Peggy Brown, should turn out to be the sister of old friends of mine in university days, Kitty Bell and Frances Kelly Bell, in whose home I had visited when I was 18, and I had met her when I was in Thailand. She was a refugee then from Laos, too dangerous for her to follow her husband there to his diplomatic post. Downstairs in the line, we greeted the 139 or so guests. This time, I'd asked special friends of mine to make a point of trying to talk with the staff of the visiting chief of state, who often seemed so left out and lonely, and I found them able lieutenants. Jane Freeman and Grace Dodd, especially, knew a lot about Korea. Had been there, were very interested. From the Senate, there were the Hollands, pretty little Mrs. Jackson and her husband Scoop, the Cottons and Senator Burdick alone, and Vicky and Roman Horoska. Vicky turned out to be one of the gayest and most helpful guests, and Noel and Joe Clark. I was happy to get the opportunity to whisper to Noel that I needed her help on our plans for the Capitol grounds. Governor Jack Burns of Hawaii, Lincoln-esque and handsome in a rugged sort of way, came without his gentle little wife, who was in a wheelchair, and the new governor of South Carolina and Mrs. McNair. Quite a coterie from the House, the Graham Purcells of Texas among them, and the most harassed man in Washington, poor dear Red Rayburn, General James Van Fleet, special friend of Korea, they tell me, considered the father of the Korean army. From Texas, Dr. and Mrs. Truman Blocker, Mrs. Douglas Shandor, widow of the artist, owner of a portrait of Eleanor Roosevelt that I wish the White House had, with an amazing halo of bright red hair, the Charlie Gibsons of Amarillo, and nobody there had more fun, and our old friends Irv and Marion Goldberg, always with us in trouble. How good to have them here with us for a gala time. And the Bell Hobbies, young, attractive, and I expect ambitious. Nicest of all was to see Mildred Stegall. That's a sort of thoughtful thing that Bess and Liz both do, even when I forget. And poet, playwright, Archibald MacLeish. And I think the nicest thing anybody said to me all evening was when he said, meeting your daughter was an electric event. Linda Bird had looked at the seating, had asked to be seated by him, had been all aglow afterward with how wonderful he was. Dr. and Mrs. Robert Scalapino, in the teach-in, he had taken the part of the administration when Mac George Bundy left so suddenly on his cloak and dagger mission. The John Secondaries, Lyndon's beautiful young friend from New York, Jean Vanderbilt, and of course our house guest, the Peter Hurds. Guests that I had hoped to see more of were the Ernest Brockets. His mother was Janet Baines, kin to Lyndon's mother, and he's now president of Gulf Oil. Since I've been working on her book, I've become more respectful toward genealogy and more interested in it. I'd hope to talk about it with him. I had the president on one side, an English-speaking Kee Young Chong, the deputy minister of economic planning, on the other side, with whom I had no difficulty at all in talking. But I admit it is work, even when I've read all the briefing and tried to learn the things of mutual interest, looking across at Lyndon with lovely little Mrs. Park on one side and the wife of their ambassador on the other. I smiled ruefully to myself. Beautifully, he spoke a sentence or two and then leaned over in urgent, tense conversation, first on one side with the vice president, then on the other with the secretary of state. Our entertainment was a friend of Abe's, Mr. Walter Trampler, who played an instrument with the delicious name of Viola d'Amore, and a very love-inducing sound it had. I had asked our guests earlier what time it was for them, according to the time in their country, and got the answer that it was something like 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. So I was relieved when they made an early goodbye, but not until after Lyndon had grabbed Mrs. Park for a whirl on the dance floor to the tune of Hello Dolly. She's a good sport, as well as a charming feminine person, and was equal to the occasion, although I dare say she'd never danced before. Lyndon left very early after that, though I knew it would not be the end of his day. But I turned on the steam to try to make it an especially gay and lively occasion for those who had come after dinner for the entertainment, such as the Philip Baldwins, who were obviously having a great time, had a sweet moment with the Goldbergs, the Gibsons, the Hobbies, strolled from group to group, and was upstairs close to one. It was next day that I found that Lyndon had worked practically all night, having gone back to the West Wing, to the Situation Room, and stayed until 4:30.